You ready for some coffee, honey?
Absolutely.
I'll pour.
Great coffee. I'm Dr. Ron Martinelli.
And I'm Linda Martinelli.
And we are Talking
While Married. Hey, Ron, I have a question for you. Are politicians heroes?
No, rarely. Sometimes, but rarely.
Okay. Well, that's kind of how I feel, too. And so the recent funeral of John McCain was a little bit disconcerting to me. Now, John McCain is a hero for sure. He was a hero in the Vietnam War. He was captured. He had lots of heroic efforts, and absolutely all of America knows that. If you've ever read his book, which I believe you've read.
I read it, and I gave it away, and I'll tell you why.
Okay. But it was a good book.
No, it was a good book. He was in the Hanoi Hilton. He used to fly Crusaders during the war. You said he was shot down. He was tortured for several years and was literally the last person to leave the prison camp that he was in.
Okay. So I will tell you why I was disconcerted by his funeral, because we had wall-to-wall coverage for really a week of eulogies and lying in state in different places. And I don't think as a politician, which John McCain was after he was in the war, I don't think as a politician that he was a hero. And we have lots and lots of heroes in all of our wars, and we don't give them the respect that he was given and the kind of the pomp and circumstance, right, that he was given.
Well, you know, I think the thing that really bothers me about the McCain funeral is that that is the type of funeral that is afforded to presidents of the United States and heads of state. And I didn't find him to be either. And I felt the entire thing was over the top. I felt it was choreographed. And I really thought that the way everything was played through the media, and I think this was, again, choreographed by McCain, that this was a slap in the face to the President of the United States. So as one of the America Out Loud columnists wrote, it's not that they love John McCain, it's that they hate President Trump. And that's what really bothered me, because he had a lot of problems as a person and as a politician, in my opinion.
Well, and as we are really lucky tonight to have Bob Prevost with us, joining us in our coffee conversation, because we happen to be out with him this evening, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. So, Bob, what's your thought?
Thousands and thousands of service people have been shot down, captured, and tortured. So this cannot be the criteria, because we've only had 32 people lie in state. And how does McCain differ? Well, McCain differs because he was a career politician. And Congress makes this decision about who lies in state. So if you just judge it on he was a hero, well, then what about the other thousands of people who have been shot down during our wars and captured and tortured, maybe even more than McCain was? I think, you know, this kind of reminds me of the Oscars. You know, the politicians have a little club, and they're honoring one of their own and excluding everybody else that made a contribution to this country, and which is exactly what they do at the Oscars. You know, they rave about each other. So I don't know if the criteria for what he got should be he was shot down. And as much as I respect anybody who serves, I don't care what capacity, I don't care if they're a medic or a pilot, they're all heroes.
I agree with you. And so here's my never-to-be-humble opinion on politicians and why I don't think that they're heroes. They take a job, just like we all take a job in life, right? Whatever that job is, this is their job that they've chosen. And so they get appointed or elected to their position, and they make a very healthy salary for that work, which a lot of Americans don't get for their work. They get a lot of perks for that work. They get cars, they get medical health care that we all, as the American public, can't even have access to, they get, hit me with some more here.
Well, first of all, they can serve only one day in office, and they get lifetime retirement. They have their own separate retirement system, their own separate medical system. And the thing that really bothers me about this is the
self-aggrandizing.
Thank you. I can't say the word. But you get what I'm talking about. They move themselves forward instead of the country, and they move themselves forward to a point where they obstruct where the United States needs to go. And you know what? Every person sitting here today has served their country in one capacity or another. So it's not like we're outsiders looking in. You know, we've all done service, and we don't need to brag about the service that they've done, and we certainly don't need to choreograph what we've done to other people.
Well, and the politicians as a whole, they get to make deals for their friends and their family. You know, they just get a lot of things that we as regular Americans don't get. And, you know, so those are the perks of the job. But a lot of them, and especially today, and we talk about this all the time, and Bob, I'm sure that you'll agree, that they obstruct the agenda of the president, they obstruct the agenda of the American people, and their infighting and their political chaos that they have is hurting all Americans. So when you have this type of a ceremony for somebody who I see as one of those politicians who obstructed, say, repealing Obamacare, which was a really big thing on the American people's agenda as we voted President Trump in to take care of that, when they obstruct the immigration issues, these people are not heroes to me and don't deserve to be recognized as such.
Well, this goes back to the basic premise of term limits. If McCain had served 6 years, would he be lying in state? Of course not. He formed a whole career based on basically being self-serving, and which I think what politicians are. They form relationships. They get benefits. They get favors. The longer they're in power, the more they get. If they'd been in power only 6 years and went home, which I think is what the founding fathers had in mind, we wouldn't be even having this discussion, because there would be no advantage for anybody to form a relationship with McCain that would self-serve them and him if he's only going to be there 6 years.
And I'm all for term limits, and this is a perfect example of why, because you're right, they just serve themselves. And when you say public servants, they don't act like our servants, they act like we are their servants, and I just have a real problem with that, and it's pervasive throughout the entire political community of today, I think.
Well, you know, I think there's lessons to be learned in this funeral. Number one, it's fine to say goodbye to somebody. The way that we say goodbye to somebody really needs to be vetted a lot better than it was. And I am, you know, angry because this was an insult to President Trump. And by the way, who gave the permission to use Air Force Two to fly John McCain and all of his family and important people from Arizona out to Washington, D.C.
Well,
okay? That was
that
President Trump. Nobody gives that permission except the President of the United States.
And he wasn't even invited to the funeral.
And John McCain, for all the friendly things that people talk about, he was a very petty man in my opinion. And I'm going to tell you why I gave the book away. First of all, the book was wonderful. It was absolutely a story of heroism. But all of the qualities that were in that book did not reconcile with the man that I saw John McCain transition to. And that's why the book that initially was an inspiration to me, I gave it away, because it became worthless several years ago, and especially during the last couple of years, while he treated other people, especially the President of the United States, so disrespectfully.
And the fact that he was willing to really to hurt all Americans so that he could kind of keep up with that pettiness against the president is my entire problem with this funeral ceremony.
You know, let me say one thing, because I mean, I want to put the whole, you know, thing sort of in perspective and talk fairly. During the election, President Trump made a cutting remark about John McCain's service, all right? And he shouldn't have done that.
Right.
Sometimes Trump goes over the top. We get that. But John McCain needed to be the bigger man and needed to let that go. And how I compare and contrast that is the scene that I saw on Fox News, where you've got Barack Obama and Michelle Obama sitting next to President Bush, all right, the younger, and they were all friendly and everything. Those two people spent their entire political career tearing George Bush apart, and they still tear George Bush apart, and George Bush is sitting right next to them, okay, as opposed to the way McCain treated the President of the United States and the President's agenda. And that's really all I want to say about that.
Bob, don't you think that they allowed this to become a media circus with making this a statement against Trump?
Well, of course it was, and this is why Trump was elected, because Trump's an outsider. And we wanted an outsider because we're tired of politicians. It's obvious, and that's why it happened the way it happened. And again, these people are lifelong career politicians, and I think the American public's sick of it. And we need to do term limits. And you need somebody like Trump. Frankly, in my opinion, just shook things up, and it kind of exposed this whole little political system for what it is. These people like Ryan and McCain, who are lame ducks. McCain's got a medical problem. Why are they serving? They can't even go vote. Okay, why are they still there? Because it's self-serving for them to stay there, even though they're incapable of serving.
Well, why did he stay after his diagnosis?
That's my question. Because it's an institution.
You know, and I totally agree with that. You know, you're going to take some of these people like Dianne Feinstein, these people in their 80s, and they're going to be carried out of there in a box because the power is too much to them. They put the power and their personal agenda over the American people. Hey, listen, speaking about obstructing things, but then people getting their way, how about President Trump doing this whole new deal with Mexico to fund our wall? What do you think?
Oh, well, that's an interesting subject to me, because you and I spoke about this together as President Trump was campaigning for president, and he kept saying that the Mexicans were going to pay for the wall, and everybody kept saying, no, they're not going to pay for the wall. But there's more than one way to skin a cat on this issue, and the way that he did it is the same way that we thought he would do it, and that is by getting more of our trade dollars back. So the deals that President Trump just made with Mexico will save Americans hundreds of billions of dollars. Yeah. And the wall costs $25 billion. So let's do the math here. Who's really paying for that wall?
Well, Trump's a deal maker, okay? If it doesn't work the first time, he's going to find another way to make a deal. If you read his book, that's what he does. And simply with Mexico, that's what he did. He's tying in trade, immigration, a lot of issues, and he's putting a bow around it and making a deal. Now, if Canada wants to play along, they're going to have to look for alternatives. But well, there are ways to make a deal.
You know, you're exactly right. As I say in Spanish, skinning the gato.
The gato.
But, you know, Mexico and Canada need the United States far more than the United States needs Mexico and Canada. Canada wouldn't even have a defense program if it wasn't for the United States. And, you know, ultimately it's going to be the same thing about China, and it's going to be the same thing about Europe. You know, they need us far more than we need them. Trump is a superior negotiator, and you may not like the way he gets things done, but I'll tell you what, I love the way he gets things done. Would I wish he would tone down a little bit in one area or another? Yeah, but then, you know, that's all part of the package, and you have to get something good to move the America, you know, forward. You've got to take a couple of lumps from time to time, and I'm willing to do that.
Well, another thing that President Trump is trying to kind of knock off his bucket list of things to do for the American people and promises that he made is about firing federal employees. So it takes 170 to 370 days to be able to fire a federal employee after the time that you decide that they need to be fired. And I don't know about you guys, but in my business, it takes about 10 minutes. So this is totally wrong, and everybody knows how I feel about federal employees and about that whole system that they, when they need to be fired, they need to be fired, and this way people will have motivation to do their job better. And so President Trump, Bob, he did some things in the last couple of weeks that are going to kind of set the tone for changing that.
And I think you're right. The American people just have a very sour taste in their mouth, and they don't care if you're a federal employee or a local a government employee. As soon as you say, I'm a government employee, they have this character in their mind about benefits, pensions, especially since pensions have gone away from the private sector, benefits, civil service rights. They can't fire me. I'm tenured. I've been here a long time. And the American public is tired of it. They remember Donald Trump's show. You're fired. They like that. They like that idea that we can get things done quickly, and that's exactly like you say he's trying to do. So we've got to clean up the civil service mess we're in. Everybody gets due process, but to carry it out over a year is ridiculous.
Well, it is.
Guess who's paying their salary while they're sitting home on administrative leave?
And actually paying for the union, expenses and that entire adjudication process.
Yeah, the overhead and all the expenses we, the public, pay. That union doesn't pay it. And the union is a private union.
Yeah, the thing that gets me, and I think everybody here has had to call a government from time to time, right? For you and me, Linda, we spent a lot of time with the California Department of Motor Vehicles.
DMV, our favorite.
Even though we live in Texas, they still hold a stranglehold on us. But when we talk with them, they're completely disrespectful, they're ambivalent, and they know that they're protected, right, through their unions and everything like that. So anything that'll move that process quicker, that's one of the things behind the VA that is killing thousands of our servicemen and women and their families through malpractice, and which includes, not providing them with timely medical service. I am all in favor of expediting.
Well, and President Trump has laid the groundwork so that the union will have to take over these particular expenses, and also that hopefully that people will have the choice of joining that federal union or not. One last thing that I'd like to say right now is there really quickly, there was a In-N-Out Burger thing in California where one of the politicians wanted to boycott In-N-Out Burger. And that was another epic fail, Ron.
Well, it's because it just underlines the fact that the Democratic Party is so intolerant. They did this in New York with Chick-fil-A, and so far it's been an abysmal failure because, hey, it's all about good customer service, it's good food at a cheap price, it had nothing to do with politics, but then you go ahead and you politicize and you weaponize food.
And a week later, they had to retract everything because they found out In-N-Out Burger was also contributing to the Democratic Party.
So 25,000 to the Republican Party.
One day their hamburgers are terrible, don't go there. And the next day, it's okay.
Yeah. Well, it's all part of the whole identity politics conversation that the Democratic Party forwards. And that's another one where the American people are absolutely sick of it and they want to see it done. And I'm doubling down with a double-double, no onions, and a Coke.
And a milkshake.
I'll join you.
I'm Dr. Ron Martinelli.
And I'm Linda Martinelli.
As former law enforcement officers, we know that your life and the lives of those you love and work with can change in an instant when you encounter an active shooter.
Unfortunately, in today's world of uncertainty, encountering an armed active shooter can have deadly consequences. That's why the key to survival is training and preparedness.
And that's why we want to invite our listeners to seriously consider taking our Response to Active Shooter training course.
Violence can happen to you anytime and anywhere and when you least expect it. Having a response and survival plan and engaging it can be the difference between life and death for you or a family member.
Our Response to Active Shooter courses are customized for the corporate, school, church, restaurant, and small business environment at a reasonable budget that fits your needs.
So don't put this life-saving training off because you don't think it will ever happen to you. We call those people victims.
Our Response to Active Shooter instructors are all nationally renowned tactical law enforcement experts who will guide you through the life-saving protocols you'll need to survive an active shooter event.
So be a victor, not a victim. Go to ResponseToActiveShooter.com to learn more today.
Remember, that's all one word, ResponseToActiveShooter.com, and be safe out there.
The Out Loud Perspective awaits you in life, love, politics, a healthy lifestyle, your faith, personal development, and living an out loud life on AmericaOutloud.com. Blitzer News and Entertainment Network, where you can listen 24/7 on our free apps on both Android and Apple. Welcome to the new era in communications, America Out Loud Talk Radio.
This is Dr. Ron Martinelli, forensic criminologist and host of A Thread of Evidence on America Out Loud. If you'd like to find out what forensic criminologists really do in the field, and you're tired of the false narratives about law enforcement and want to unpack the cases that I've worked throughout the nation, then please pick up a copy of my new book, The Truth Behind the Black Lives Matter Movement and the War on Police, on sale right now at Amazon.com. That's The Truth Behind the Black Lives Matter Movement and the War on Police at Amazon.com. So Dr. Ron and Linda on the road again.
On the road again, and this is a big on the road.
This is the big one, okay? This is the yearly bucket list trip, and we're in Budapest, Hungary on scenic cruises, and we're en route to do the Rhine River cruise all the way up to Amsterdam. And what a pleasure, because we've got our good buddy Bob Prevost. Bob and I are on the Forensic Death Investigations team, and we're on A Thread of Evidence, and it's just great to have them today.
This is a nice break from work, and hope to see some great sights along the way. This is a beautiful country out here.
Yeah, no reports on dead guys.
we've got the death investigations team party of six here.
That's it.
With us, and so
Lance Martini,
Lance Martini, his
ballistic
wife,
scientist.
Diana. Bob and his wife Connie, and us, so we should be taking Europe by storm.
And
here.
We took all year to plan this trip, and it's so exciting to have you here, Bob, and everybody else.
Well, you know, I wanna just bring up one little thing. When we got off the airplane, they sent a driver for us, and the driver came, took us, and we had a really nice conversation with him. Really nice young man, but he was born and bred and raised here in Budapest on the Buddhist side, because Budapest has two sides. So the river divides them, the Danube, right?
Right. Yeah, river. Danube River, yeah. Buda and Pest.
Right, divides them. And one side is kind of flat and more business, and one side is very hilly. It's really an interesting topography here. Now, he lived for a year in Sherman Oaks, and in California, which was really interesting.
And he's an interesting guy because he's a professional gambler.
A professional poker
player. Poker player, yeah.
Right. But he couldn't stand, as we had the same issue with California, with the traffic and the cost of living. And so he came back home here.
I always wanted to say something. Mm-hmm. It was so funny to hear a guy from Budapest talk about traffic on the 405.
I know, yeah, it was. But the thing that, because I always ask the questions, you know, about their economy and, you know, what's different. Well, he's talking about the economy here in Budapest, which, by the way, is a republic. It's really the same type of system that we have in the United States here, where their officials are elected. And he was talking about their economy here is booming. And we asked what the difference is between when President Obama was president and President Trump is president. And he was just all for the President Trump presidency because of the economy, and that he can really see how a businessman has made the difference, which when we are doing well in America, they do well in Europe. And when we were here last time, Ron, what we found was when President Obama was president, when we were here, and the economy was not doing well, and they blamed us here for that.
Yeah, that's really true.
Yeah, I rode with a guy from Zurich to Budapest yesterday on the plane, and he is a... I said, what do you do? He says, I design trains. And he says, because of the economy right now, he says, we design them here. He says, we're looking for a contract in California on the new train system.
Oh, my God, not the bullet train. We got to talk about that.
But here's the thing. You guys live in Texas? That's where they're going to build them, in Texas.
Oh, they're going to build them in Texas.
Good.
And truck
we get
them
the
over
work.
To California.
Wow.
Well,
<it's>, like that.
Well, because where would you rather have a business, Texas or California?
Oh no, there's
oh,
no
hands down.
Yeah. He says that's what we've done. So he says it's you know, everything's cause and effect, and it causes an effect worldwide. He says we have this because of President Trump's new policies and and, you know, roll back on regulations and the way the economy is, we're able to now compete and do this.
Well, you know, I thought it was so interesting, and that's why with Linda and I, Bob, when we travel, it's all about the relationships that we develop with people internationally. And I thought it was very interesting. Obviously, Hungary is part of the EU, you know, the European Union, but they're on their own monetary system. They're not on the euro, which I thought was a little bit strange.
Well, Czech Republic is like that too right now.
Okay.
They're supposed to go to euro next year.
Okay.
And all that is subject to... We'll see what happens.
And actually, he likes being in the European Union. He finds that it's beneficial to the country. But we thought, you know, his comments on how their parliament works and the republic here was very interesting. As a matter of fact, where we are right now on the scenic boat, the Amber, we are parked or docked right across from the parliament building, which has got to be one of the most gorgeous parliament buildings in Europe, and it's the second largest parliament building in Europe, Great Britain, London being the big one.
Yeah, it's a beautiful building, and as we sit here in the evening, it's all lit up, and it's absolutely gorgeous.
And when you see the Rhine River Cruise commercials on television, it's usually the first one you see. I don't care what company, Viking, Princess,
right.
Whatever,
right.
That's where it starts, and they show it. And you know, Lynn, I'm thinking, I took so many pictures last night of the beautiful lit-up city and the Parliament building. We've got to post on Facebook and just so that people can enjoy that.
Well, you know, the first thing I need to do is kind of get my time clock back in order here because we really traveled almost for 24 hours getting here and took three different flights, and I'm okay. A little bit discombobulated with that.
Hey, you know, Bob, with all the stuff's going on right now in California, and you and I are both California natives, you're still in California. I bailed out a couple of years ago. Why would anybody want to be a cop in California anymore?
It's getting to be so difficult now that of course they're having problems recruiting again. This kind of takes me back to the Vietnam days, the Vietnam protests and the era and the civil rights. It was hard to recruit officers back in those days, and I'm seeing it again now. So.
Well, you know, it's interesting you bring back the Vietnam War days, because that's when I started in police work. You were ahead of me. You were my first training officer back in 1974. Mm-hmm. And I just see us coming full circle, which is scary on the recruiting end.
Yeah, but for different reasons. And I think California's problems are being generated by within California.
Well, you know, go ahead. I'm sorry.
The judicial system we have, it's very liberal, the political system we have, and it seems like the police just don't feel they're being backed anymore.
You know, when you and I got on the job and we joined law enforcement, we weren't in it to make any money. It was a community service for us. Yes, it's a good job. It was a steady income. There's a good retirement system. But we got in to help the community. And with everything that's going on right now, with how Jerry Brown is changing with the legislature and everything and all these new law changes, it's really hurting the public, and it hurts a police officer's opportunity to help the public and give back.
Yeah, you know, they just passed he just signed legislation to get rid of the bail system last week or 2 weeks ago, and I'm not sure how that's going to play out, but somehow they expect the police to go out and find these people when they don't show up in court. Well, the police already have too much to do, and they're not going to have time to do that. That used to be jobs for the bail companies.
Well, you know, I think that a lot of people that aren't familiar with what's happening in law enforcement and the criminal justice system in California, they think that police go out there and they make warrant arrests. That's a thing of the past after Prop 109 and Prop 47. I mean, you have an outstanding burglary suspect with a felony warrant for burglary who's absconded from the court. If an officer detains that guy and runs him for warrants, he doesn't even pick him up and take him in anymore.
Right.
And he writes him basically a ticket and a promise to appear in court, which is ludicrous because he's already absconded, like he's going to show up in court.
Yeah, and you go to places like San Francisco where they're not going to prosecute drug cases. And it kind of demotivates officers from going out and working drug cases. Why bother? You're going to do all this effort to get somebody in jail, and the district attorney's not going to even file on it.
Well, you know, you're exactly right. So we've talked about the bail system, and they're going to throw that out the window, which, by the way, this is another example of California government not resonating with the business community, because all the bail bondsmen are going to get tossed out and their businesses are going to go defunct. But now he's signing legislation where he's going to free all the death row inmates from death row. Now, he's still going to keep them, but he wants to take them out of death row, and he wants to commute the sentence to life without possibility of parole.
Well, now, I'm not sure that he has signed anything at this point. It's a fear in California, because Jerry Brown is definitely against the death penalty and always has been. And the fear is, and the path was just paved for him by a federal judge or Supreme Court judge in California, that that he could do this, where in the past he's had some roadblocks. Now he can do it, and the fear in California is, and the kind of certainty is, that on his way out of office, he is going to commute these sentences, which we could go through, but it would be a really gruesome conversation, what these people on death row have done to other human beings, and to commute their sentences, I just think is despicable. And the California population has voted against removing the death penalty over and over. So we do not want the death penalty removed in California. So here's another politician deciding that he knows better than the population of California who put him in office, and that I find despicable as well.
What's even more scary is that I still have one person, when I worked homicide, in prison for life without parole. He was put there when he was 18. He's probably in his 50s now. The governor, life without parole means life without parole, except you can be pardoned. And my fear is that on the way out, I hate to see this governor start pardoning all these people and just literally letting them out.
Well, it really bothers me. My first homicide with San Jose Police Department was the rape, sodomy, and murder, violent murder, of a two-year-old girl. And actually, no, I'm sorry, she was 3 years old. And that guy got the death penalty. And so I know he's on death row. But what a despicable, horrible, evil man. And I was happy to see him go to death row. I was looking forward to his execution date. And now, with this looming, now I'm really worried about this particular guy eventually being released. Then there's the new talk now about the felony murder rule and getting rid of the felony murder rule. Linda, have you heard about that?
I did hear about that. And, you know, you need to explain that again to me, because I read about it. And that was where, if you are in the commission of a crime, and somebody dies during your commission of a crime, unless you were actually the person that murdered them before, you could be charged with murder, and now you cannot?
Well, Bob, you know, you're our homicide expert.
Yeah,
why don't you chime in on that?
Here's a good example. I'm driving the getaway car from a bank robbery, and the bank robber goes in there and he kills the teller. He comes, runs out of the bank, and I drive him away. Okay? I can be charged for that.
Yes.
Okay, now he wants to get... Well, I'm as complicit as the guy who went in the bank.
Absolutely.
I'm helping him escape.
And, you know, this is behavior modification, like with all crimes. If you have no strict penalties, then where is the behavior modification,
right,
or the fear of potential felons that, you know, don't commit a crime because I could get hit with the felony murder rule? That's completely gone. But what really bothers me about this is that now Brown is talking about those guys that were already adjudicated and convicted,
yes,
and sentenced in felony murder. He's talking about commuting their sentences because,
right,
it's unfair. Wait a minute. These guys have already been adjudicated.
Well, and you know, it's interesting because Jerry Brown talks a lot about this being unfair and that being unfair. But here's what's unfair to me. It's unfair to the population of California and really the rest of the country, because felons don't stay in one place. They travel all around. So it's unfair to all of us people to have all of these people freed, to re-victimize us again and again and again. And it goes back to, what do these people think, that they don't want to make anybody accountable for their behavior and their crimes, so that we as citizens have to pay that price over and over and over, both in our lives, in injuries, in court costs, in fear, in retrying these people, and our police department's having to go out and rearrest these people, the costs are just tremendous that we keep letting these prisoners out to re-victimize all of us.
Well, go ahead, Bob. Well,
look at the three-strike rule. If a person's going to get his third strike, and you know how many strikes they throw out all the time when they negotiate, when that person realizes, okay, the next time I'm really going away, they go to another state and they victimize other people and start over.
Oh, exactly right.
And it's ridiculous.
Well, the whole thing is ridiculous. And with Prop 109 that they passed and Prop 47 that they bamboozled the public a couple of years ago, they've released tens of thousands of felons back onto the street in California. And, you know, Bob, Linda and I own a firearms training company, and we do the Carrying Concealed Weapons program, and that company has just gone through the roof because people are scared, and they're going around, and now they're carrying concealed. They want permits and things like that. You know, the last thing I want to talk about just briefly, and they've shelved it, but now the legislature is entertaining a Senate bill. I don't remember what the money, the Assembly bill, I don't remember what the number is, but it's the proportional force one, where they remove the constitutional requirements of what we call Graham versus Connor, right, with regards to force and deadly force, and they want to make it proportional. What that could potentially do is that could put a lot of police officers in prison for just doing their jobs and defending themselves.
If they, even if they appeal it and it gets up to a federal court and gets to the Supreme Court, they're going to look at Graham versus Connor, and eventually these officers are going to get adjudicated, they're going to be fine.
Right.
But it's going to take 5 years to get there. And meanwhile, their careers are gone.
And their lives are a shambles, yeah, and their families are just a shambles.
Well,
why do people want to do that?
And so are the public lives, because without the police officers there to have our backs, we're going to have anarchy in this country. We are going to have criminals running rampant, and we can't do that. So why we want to harm those that are helping us, I don't understand.
Well, and future applicants are going to look at that and say, I'm not taking that chance.
Well, they already are.
Well,
they already are.
Exactly. And we have a police officer's son in California. So our hearts go out to all these men and women that wear the badge. Their job is so important for society, but you got to give them the tools.
And speaking of heroes, they're my heroes.
Think back to the last time you felt healthy and energized. The best times of our lives occur when we're at the peak of our health, sleeping better, full of energy and focus. We know that fades with age, and you might be feeling the effects of aging as low energy and poor sleep. But it doesn't have to be that way. There haven't been any nutrition systems designed to rejuvenate our bodies as we get older, until now. Healthy Cell Pro is the only multi-nutrient system that impacts the building block of your body, the cell. Created by anti-aging expert and Nobel Prize nominee, Dr. Vincent Giampapa, award-winning Healthy Cell Pro cuts through the complexity of nutrition supplements by simply giving you the purest ingredients, filling dietary gaps to nourish your cells and enhance your quality of life for optimal performance. Visit HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for an exclusive discount, or call 844-869-9958.
Tired of watching the same old sporting events? Well, kick it up a notch and get ready, America, for something you've never seen before. It's the new generation of Western superstars. Shorty Gorham's American freestyle bullfighting. Who will win? The acrobatic, tough-as-nails Western superstar, or the meanest half-ton fighting bulls on Earth? This is one of the most extreme sports you'll ever see in an arena. This is hand-to-horn combat on a level playing field. Go to ShortyGorhamAFB.com or find them on Facebook. It's bullfighting time.
Well, Ron, science has said that parents of successful kids have 11 things in common. And I think it's really interesting because psychology has found that the parents have a huge impact on the success of the children.
Well, I think you and I both understand how important it is for kids to have both parents actively engaged in rearing them. And we've got four kids, and you know, we have remained engaged in their lives, and hell, they're into their 30s now.
Well, we're absolutely
we're still fully engaged with them.
but I really like these things, and I want to talk about them.
Well, let's
do that. Yeah, so there's 11 different things that parents can do that'll help make their kids more successful.
What's the first one?
They make their kids do chores. And I think that that's so important. I mean, my mom made us, I will never forget, I used to wash the walls, take the bucket out and pick weeds. And, you know, it just, before I could do anything else, or even if I wanted to buy myself something or earn a few pennies, I had to do a chore to earn it. How about you?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, you got to remember, my dad was a veterinarian. And so I picked up more than, you know, my share of dog poop. But here was a really important chore for me when I was growing up, and I started doing this when I was about 11 or 12 years old. I had to cook dinner for the family on many nights because both my mom and dad worked. And what was really cool, they knew I liked cooking. My dad was a great cook, and he taught me how to make a bunch of dishes that I could put in the oven. I could prepare them and I could put them in the oven. You know, the first dish that I remember doing was how to make a roasted chicken in like a Browning bag or something. And I would come home from school at 12 years old, and I knew how to chop the vegetables, you know, clean them, chop the vegetables, get the Browning bag out, clean the chicken, and put that in. But I would cook a lot of our meals so that when mom and dad came home, things were ready to go.
Well, and what they say is that what kids learn from that is that they have to do the work of life in order to be part of life. And it also helps them later in life to collaborate with their coworkers and also to have more empathy for people because they understand what their jobs entail. I think that's a really, really good point.
I agree.
Secondly, they teach their kids social skills. And you and I have talked about this a lot of times because social skills are so very important. I know that when I interview people in my business, so many of the young people don't have good social skills. Now, not all of them, a lot of them do. And I think that this article is really correct in that it does come from what you learn at home. So if you communicate at home, then you're going to be able to communicate in the workplace and in public.
No, that's really important, and especially now with the electronic age where everybody is into their, you know, texting and they're not talking to each other, you've got to have those social graces, as we refer to them, so that you can bring something to the table when you are talking with people. So important.
And what they actually found in their study is that people with very limited social skills have a higher chance of getting arrested, binge drinking, applying for public housing, as opposed to kids who you can actually tell as early as kindergarten that they, if they have better social skills, they have been proven to go on to have more successful lives.
And you know,
lives.
That makes a lot of sense to me because they're not engaged. And when you're not engaged, you don't make friends. And when you don't make friends, you don't have your social support systems so that when you're experiencing some, you know, problems in your life, some downtimes, you don't have that support system. And, you know, you can get depressed, you can start self-medicating, you know, using drugs, drinking alcohol, things like that. So that makes a lot of sense to me.
Well, the next one is that the parents have high expectations of their kids. So what they found is that parents that hold high expectations for their kids have a huge effect on what those kids attain in life.
And, you know, that seems also to sort of be a cultural issue as well because, you know, our parents were Italian, yours were Italian and Dutch. They had high expectations of us, and they held our nose to the grindstone. I know a lot of other cultures, the Asian cultures, expect a lot out of their kids, and they stay on top of them. So I think the follow-up, not only having the demands, but making sure that your kids follow through with goals and objectives is really important, especially in their formative years with school.
Yeah, and you know, what they say is that what one person expects of another can come to serve as a self-fulfilling prophecy. So if your parents expect nothing of you, then you probably won't produce anything. But if your parents have high expectations of you and groom you to those expectations, then your production in life will be much better.
And you know, I think the key word that you said, Linda, was grooming. And to me, grooming means giving the proper encouragement, not pressuring the kids, overly pressuring the kids, and you know, molding them and giving them encouragement, because kids are going to fail. And I think part of the learning process and the maturity process is helping your kids to accept failing and to learn something from that failure and to move on.
Right. And what they also talk about is that families that are in conflict with one another, so if the parents are in conflict with one another, that affects the kids for up to 10 years after they leave the home. So they really, the conflict in the home is a big deal in this particular article. The next thing that helps kids to be successful in life is that they are educated.
Yeah, you know, education is a key, and there's a lot of different forms of education. Obviously, formulative education from elementary and secondary schools is really important, but I think a key thing is not holding the kids and pressuring them to go to college, because not every kid is cut out to go to college. But trade schools and other forms of education are equally important. I think the best form of education is getting those kids out there and having them expand their social skills, their networking, and getting out there and just getting a job and working, learning how to make an income.
And unfortunately, we've lost a lot of our apprenticeship programs that we used to have.
Right.
The junior colleges are kind of taking up that slack, especially in California. If you want to be a welder, or you want to be an electrician, or you want to be something that doesn't require a bachelor's degree, they fill that need. Junior college is pretty cheap to go to, but then it's, like you just said, it's motivating the kids to take that first step and get in there and do it.
And just to tell you how important parents are to kids is that when the educational level of the parents in the home when a child is about 8 years old really dictates that child's educational levels down the road. That's certainly not 100% of the time, but just statistically. So the better educated the parents are, the better educated tend to be the children in that family.
Yeah, you know, I agree. And I think kids look at the educational level of their parents and they see what their parents have accomplished. And again, if the parenting is right, if the mentoring is right, the kids are not intimidated by that. And they look at that and they say, wow, you know, look what my mom and dad accomplished with what they had. And maybe I can do that too.
Yeah. And you know, the problem now is you're talking about parents motivating their kids. Half this country has a one parent family. And just to go to work, get them fed at night, get them to do their homework is a big deal, because they're doing mother and father duties, and it's really not Leave It to Beaver anymore. It's a whole different culture, and
yeah,
it makes it really tough.
And it is, you know, and so many of those kids, especially in minority families, are being raised by the single parent who is the mother and who may also have one or two jobs. So it's an extremely difficult task to take on. I know Dr. Ben Carson's mom was a great example of that, and he turned out to be an amazing success.
Well, and that goes to really the next one on the list, which is that parents need to develop a relationship with their children. And it's not just that relationship of, you know, I'm the mom or I'm the dad and you're the kid. It's a relationship. It's talking and communicating and having a whole relationship, and that is extremely valuable. And when we talk sometimes about single parent homes, like you say, Bob, parents sometimes they're worn out from their day. They're doing everything themselves, and they you know, have a hard time getting that relationship with the kids. And then the next thing, which I thought was really interesting, but I can see the point, is teaching children mathematics early. And it's a whole cognitive processing thing in their brain. It helps them read better later. It helps them process better later. And that, I had not thought about that, but it makes a lot of sense, doesn't
well,
it?
Well, you know, my folks, my mom really worked with me really hard on the math. I got to tell you, it didn't take, because I think I flunked every math class I ever had. But what I enjoyed about that relationship, even though it was really hard for me, is I respected my mom because she put the time in with me.
Yeah. And another thing, you know, like last weekend I spent probably 2 or 3 hours with my grandkids working on their math. Again, it's a single parent. The father's raising them. The mother's part-time. But grandparents play a pretty big role now in raising kids.
Oh, absolutely.
And, because they've got the time.
Yeah. Hey, Bob, can you talk more about that? Because Linda and I are not yet grandparents, right?
Yeah, we have 11 grandkids.
Oh, my gosh.
Okay, so we have a little experience. But what we do, when the kids come up to see us, the first thing they want to do is go to the video game, the iPhone, the iPad, and we just turn it all off and say, nope, we're going to do math, or we're going to, Connie will have them working on a craft project or something with their hands, because they're not getting that anymore.
Yeah, you're right.
And unfortunately, parents come home. These little toys and the TV are babysitters while they make dinner, and then they say, oh, yeah, just go sit over there, because now mom's going to night school to try and get a better job, so she's busy, or dad, and so there's no time to do all this, and grandparents become a very important part of the life.
You know, we never hear about them.
No, but if you look at a lot of, where I've noticed it is in the NFL, a lot of these players, they make the Super Bowl, or they get a, and who do they thank? Their grandparents, because a lot of them, the grandparents raised them.
Oh, absolutely. So another one is that they learn to value effort over avoiding failure. So there's two mindsets. One is that the goal is just to succeed, that you're, it's kind of a fixed mindset. But the other one is a growth mindset, which thrives on the challenge and sees failure not as unintelligence, but just another stepping stone to getting where you want to go. And I think that's a really great lesson too. The other one, which I think is really interesting, and I'm not so sure I agree with, but I'm not the scientist, is that moms work. So they've found that moms that work seem to have children that end up being more successful in life. And I guess that is a good thing, but I also think that there's a whole lot of value in moms who stay home.
Well, if you're a two-parent couple and mom's working because she's making more money than dad and dad's staying home, I think that works out great.
Yeah,
I do
too.
But when you have just mom and mom's doing everything and there is no dad in the picture, that's a whole... Imagine the trauma on the kids, okay? First, the parents split up. That's trauma, okay? And then they're not going to agree on how to raise the kid because they haven't agreed on anything anyhow. So now the kid's caught in the middle on what to do. Every time the kid's with one parent or the other, they're getting conflicting ideas on what they should be doing. It's tough.
Yeah, and what another predictor of, you know, kids that become more successful in life is that they have a little bit higher socioeconomic status. So obviously, you can really figure out that kids that are born into severe poverty don't have as many opportunities in life to get ahead. They're just trying to survive at that point.
Yeah, I think that the whole survival thing is an extreme distraction to their future development. You know, if you're so distracted, like in some of the really rough neighborhoods, you know, there's gunfire, there's all sorts of stuff. That's pretty distracting.
Well, there's, like I saw working in California, I worked narcotics for many years. You go into these homes and they're dealing drugs right out of the house, and the kids are trying to do their homework, and we're knocking down the front door, arresting the parents for drug dealing.
It's so sad to see that.
It's sad. It's
yeah.
Terrible.
Well, I mean, I think that these are really, really interesting, and I really agree with them that they're really good. They're good indicators of kids that have a good path to become successful in life, and you know that's important. It's important for all of us to know. And you know what, guys, I am coffeed out right now, and I'm gonna probably hit the sack here, but I am really, really looking forward. This is day one of a 3-week adventure, and I'm really excited to, you know, be sharing it with everybody, and we just have lots and lots of more things to talk about coming up.
Well, that's true, and you know, it's going to be Budapest all day today, and tonight we're en route to Vienna, Austria.